You are listening to The Grandest Tour by The Cycling Podcast, brought to you by iWocker. Flexible loans built for small businesses. iwoca.co.uk.
Today, we are at the Giro d'Italia.
Daniel, we appear to be walking behind a couple of members of a Groupama FDJ or CCC. Well, they're about 12 feet tall. And what are they, Rich?
These enormous sort of stickmen. I don't know. They were like giant human pogo sticks. We're walking in Mileto, which is where the stage has just started today, up a beautiful pink promenade, sort of improvised for the Giro, which goes quite some distance, probably a few hundred metres up the main street from one church to another. Quite impressive. And it's quite festive. It feels quite festive, certainly by the standards of this year's Giro. We've said that it's been a bit subdued, a bit muted, but this town is out in technicolour, isn't it?
Yeah, there's a lot of paint. There are a few buildings that could do without a fresh coat of paint, but they've used all the paint on the road. They've painted it pink.
Or a gentleman we've just seen has painted his whole head pink, which is quite impressive. See him?
Yeah, he's got pink hair.
I've never seen that before. Wow.
But pink head. But he looks like he's just sort of very businesslike. What he strolled off. Maybe just the natural colour of his head.
But completely bald, and it's not hair dye, it's head dye.
Didn't even look interested in the Giro. Maybe it's just a coincidence. But yeah, it's really, there's pink, there are a lot of balloons, there are a lot of banners saying Mileto, Giro d'Italia, and there is a greater sense here, well, a greater buzz, a lot of people out as well, and it's the first time we've seen that this Giro. We're also walking past a park here, Daniel, with a very elaborate and expensive-looking monument, memorial to Vincenzo Torriani, the legendary, fearsome director of the Giro for many years. The question is why?
Well, that's a very good question, because we saw it and I was thinking that it slipped my mind that Torriani was either from this town or had some kind of obvious connection to this town. Of course, Torriani was from Milan or near Milan, so I was slightly confused, and I've not really been able to find out too much more. I asked a few people, and it seems that Torriani was just mates with the mayor or some sort of local official back in the 80s when he was still director of the Giro, and I think the monument was inaugurated in 1981. But it's probably one of the more impressive structures in the town, isn't it?
It's very, is it as old as that? Because it looks quite modern. It's also got the dates on it of all the times the Giro has been here.
Sorry, my mistake. I think he became an honorary citizen of Mileto in 1981. I'm not actually sure when the monument was built.
So the Giro came here in 1930, 1949, 1954, 1961, 1965, 1972, and 1976. Well, Daniele Fribrincini, that was us at the start in Mileto this morning. It's now dark and cold and wet.
Buonasera, Riccardo Moresotto. You like that name, don't you?
I've had worse.
Yeah, you're looking quite smug when I say that. Yeah, cold, but we're in our castle, not in the treehouse, unfortunately. A bit of a misunderstanding
well,
there.
Unfortunately or slightly fortunately. Because
anyway,
we've got very nice rooms, and that's probably better than a treehouse. It's been a cold, wet day, but yeah, lovely. What a salubrious setting this is.
Yes, it is. And it wasn't so salubrious this morning, was it? On the way to Mileto, I took you on a bit of a guided tour of some of the less salubrious parts of Calabria. It kind of pains me to talk about it, because we've spoken about it every year, but the RCS keep taking us through the sort of mafia, the 'Ndrangheta heartlands. I just wanted to, to temper slightly the sort of negative things I've said about that part of the world in previous years. So we were in Rosarno today on the way to the start. The closest town to Mileto was Rosarno, and I said to you, it's the town in Italy, well, it's been hailed as, not hailed, it's probably the wrong word, it's described as the town in Italy with the highest rate of criminality.
Infamous, it's infamous.
Yeah, and it's, it's been said that it's completely controlled by the 'Ndrangheta, which is the Calabrian mafia. I was doing a bit of reading about it today, and there's a project or a group, an association that's been formed there over the last 10 years called SOS Rosarno, and they are trying to change the image of Rosarno. And one of the focuses of mafia power there has been the citrus fruit industry. And this organization, SOS Rosarno, they're trying to address really two problems at the same time, two of Rosarno's problems. One is, over the last 10 or 15 years, there have been a lot of African immigrants there who have been living in squalid conditions, terrible conditions, and been exploited by this mafia-controlled citrus industry. And SOS Rosarno have set up these cooperatives, and they've given work legal jobs, because a lot of the African immigrants that are brought over end up working for as little as €5 or €4 a day illegally. And this organization, SOS Rosarno, set up these cooperatives where they've really cut out the middleman, and they've tried to loosen the grip of the mafia on the citrus industry. The other industry, of course, that area, Rosarno, and the port of Gioia Tauro, which is a couple of kilometers away, is famous for, unfortunately, is cocaine smuggling. The majority, I think, of the cocaine comes into Europe, it has been said, again, it's been reported, comes in through that port. But what did you make of it, Rich,
well,
when we drove through there?
We skirted the outskirts. Did you not say as well that people can buy that citrus directly? You know, you said they cut out the middleman so they can actually...
And olive oil as well.
And they can buy it directly, and know that the money goes into the pockets of the workers.
Look them up, SOS Rosarno, that's Rosarno.
Well, you had told me about Rosarno, and I was very curious. It's a sort of morbid curiosity, isn't it? Or voyeuristic curiosity to see what it's like. It wasn't very appealing. It wasn't a place I would have liked to have spent a lot of time. However, I would have liked, you know, it's the kind of place you'd like to just delve into a little bit. Unfortunately, there's a sort of attractive edginess to places like that.
Yeah, and I think, you know, you're not alone in feeling that morbid fascination for it. There have been a lot of Italian documentaries or documentary makers that have gone there in recent years meet and or try to meet and sort of dig into the roots a little bit of the two clans, the famous clans there, the Pesce family clan and the Bellocco family clan. And as I say, it's made the news a lot in Italy over the last decade or so.
And you told me about the football club as well.
Well, it was established a few years ago that the football club, semi-professional football club, had been, again, as a lot of businesses are, a lot of organisations have been there, under the control of the 'Ndrangheta, the Pesce clan, I think it was. But the police sort of dismantled a lot of the businesses and a lot of the interests of one of these clans, and they found themselves basically in control of the football club. And so the local police had to manage the football club for however many months it was thereafter.
Brilliant.
Which was quite a curious story.
Well, it's funny, isn't it? Because, well, we'll get onto the Giro d'Italia in a moment. I do promise. We were talking recently about the Tour de France showing only really one side of France.
Well, exactly. It occurred to me today.
And, you know, the Giro cannot really be accused of that, especially when it comes down to the south. And it's here because Sicily obviously has a relationship with the Giro and an arrangement for the Giro to go there. But, you know, we haven't seen the best of Italy over the first few days of the Giro. And that, in a sense, that's puts it in contrast to the Tour de France. The Tour de France wouldn't come to places like the places that we've been. It wouldn't start in some of the start towns we've been
in. You're absolutely right. And you know, one of the accusations often thrown at RCS is that they snub the south. I suppose there might be some notes of regret or in the fact that, you know, when they have been to the south in recent years, or when we have been to the south with the Giro, we haven't maybe seen some of the more photogenic areas of certainly Calabria and or Sicily.
Even Sicily, I would say. Stage 5 today, from Mileto to stage 5 today from Mileto to Camigliatello Silano. 225 kilometres. A long stage with a lot of climbing, an early start, relatively
almost
10, 25.
Almost 4,000 metres of climbing.
3,700 metres of climbing today at the Giro d'Italia. and an unlikely winner, but I'll get on to that. A breakaway took a while to form, actually, 50 kilometres or so. Four riders went clear. Jan Tratnik of Barry McLaren, Carl Frederick Hagen of Lotto Soudal rode a very good Vuelta last year, didn't he? And Filippo Ganna and Salvatore Puccio of Ineos Grenadiers. Another four riders got across. Valerio Conti, a real favourite for today's stage. Hector Carretero from Movistar. Jonathan Restrepo from Androni, used to ride for Katusha, Colombian rider. Not a typical Colombian rider. He's quite a big ruler type rider. And Eduardo Zardini from Vini Zabu.
Whose fan club were out in force in Mileto this morning. They had these wonderful Dayglow yellow jerseys on with very big writing. Io tifo Zardini. I support Zardini.
And his team were a man down, unfortunately, after yesterday.
I got a bit of news on that. Yeah. I spoke to the team sponsor, well, the president of the team sponsor, and Valentino Schotti, who's been supporting teams for a long time. And so he's the guy behind Farnese Vini. Zabu Vini is a part of that company. And that team, their manager Luca Shinto, or their direct sportive Luca Shinto and Valentino, are quite reluctant to say too much.
This is a problem, isn't it?
It is a big problem because they're obviously a wild card selection for this Giro.
We should explain, just to scroll back a bit, that this was the incident at the end of the stage yesterday where a helicopter was pretty low and some barriers were blown by the helicopter into the path of a group of riders. And, two riders from that team were hit particularly
including Luca Wackerman, who has been on very good form and was riding pretty high on general classification as well. So they lost two
riders. He's got horrific injuries.
Yes, very bad. And they're in a bit of a bind because they got one of the wildcard picks for this Giro, and a few years ago a team sponsored by the same company, they had a rider, Daniele Colli, who collided with one of those big cardboard hands it was a sprint finish, and the team then took quite a strong position. They were very critical of the organisation, RCS. I think they were threatened or undertook legal action against RCS, and they then didn't get a wild card for the next several years. I'm not saying emphatically that those two things were linked, but certainly when I spoke to, as I said, Valentino Schotti today, he was quite outraged at what the helicopter pilot had done yesterday. He'd definitely been flying too close to the riders, but didn't want to say too much publicly.
That is problematic. Brent Bookwalter was quite critical of, you know, what happened, and well, this issue of safety is ongoing, and I'm sure we'll return to it. Might be worth a kilometre zero at some point during this Giro, actually.
We're going to talk exploding bedons or non-exploding bedons.
We're going to talk about that, aren't we? We're going to talk about that. So we've got our breakaway there, 165 kilometres still to go. The big obstacle today was a big Category 1 climb. We climbed alongside it, didn't we, in the car, in our new car. We had to swap cars today. Problem with our new inferior car, the Valico Montescuro climb, a big long climb, not too steep, and then there was quite a treacherous little descent into the finish. And one of the riders doing a lot of work in that breakaway was Ganna, who won the stage one time trial, of course, and so the theory was that he was trying to help Puccio, his teammate. But as that break began to break apart, it was Ganna who emerged at the front. He looking very, very strong.
Lo Spaghettone.
Spaghettone. Well, he might have another nickname. We'll hear about that later on in this episode. Carretero, the Movistar rider, also looked very strong and was riding very well. Zardini was riding well as well. But eventually it was Thomas de Gendt came across to that group from the bunch with Einar Rubio, a young Colombian on Movistar. Rubio didn't work with de Gendt as they bridged across. Understandably, he had a teammate up the road. But curiously, he didn't work with de Gendt once they got to the group as well. And there are a few games ensued, and we'll hear from de Gendt and Rubio in a moment. Well, should we hear from them now about what happened? Because Ganna, who kept getting dropped and coming back, he just rode away from the pair of them. They appeared to let him go, and once he was gone, he was really gone. And 83 kilos, the heaviest rider in the race, he rode to the top of the climb alone and plunged down into the finish and won the stage. A fantastic victory for him. But really, Rubio and De Gendt were playing games behind. Here's what both of them said at the finish. First, De Gendt, and then Rubio.
I think I had the legs to beat him, but I had somebody in my wheel that didn't want to do anything of the work to close the gap and then to maintain the gap to the bunch. So Ganna got dropped, I think, one or two times when Rubio attacked, and then I attacked as well one time. But he still didn't want to work, and then Ganna did a move, and I just felt that it was not my time to close the gap, and I was waiting for Rubio, and he didn't do anything. So for me, it's okay if Ganna wins. Just Rubio couldn't win today. It's with his weight on this climb, it's for sure. It's impressive. The last 3-4 kilometers were not that steep anymore. It was a bit for him more, but. He survived the steep part, so it was good for him.
What kind of response did you get from Rubio? I saw you speaking to him or trying to speak to him. Did you get anything out of him?
He didn't say anything. He just didn't make an effort. He didn't want to pull once in the chase. He had the team in the front, so I could understand. But once we came across to his teammate, he still didn't want to do anything of the work, and then he started attacking. So I made it my goal to not let him win. I'm not good downhill, so if you made it to the top with just the two of us, then he would drop me in the downhill without doing any work, and that's just that wouldn't be fair. So then I prefer Ganna to win than Rubio. That's just how cycling works.
Lo intentamos, bueno, faltó algo.
Well, we tried and just fell slightly short. I'm feeling better and better, more and more confident, and I'll definitely try again over the next few days. Just riding in the bunch is getting easier all the time. The plan today was just to get into the break. It didn't work at first, but then I kept going, and finally, off I went. Well, there we go, old Ainer Rubio riding his first Grand Tour, I think, for Movistar, second in the Baby Giro last year. He said, you know, he was off for a nice day out. He was delighted with how things had gone. And then...
De Gendt, not impressed.
No, De Gendt put a big Belgian, Flemish, deadpan...
He seemed happy that
got pin in his balloon.
Yeah. I guess... Movistar here, I guess, for stage wins. They've had a very poor season, haven't they? They're a team in transition. Rubio could be a guy that they build a team around, perhaps, in the future. He's obviously a very talented young Colombian.
He could be, Rich. And, you know, I've taken to this, to doing this at the Tour de France now. I published this list of altitudes of birthplaces, the top 10 on general classification by the altitude of their birthplace. Rubio is from a place called Chiquita, and it's at 2,900 metres above sea level.
He's going to win the Tour de France.
He's second only. In the current peloton, I think he's lagging behind Richard Carapaz, who, of course, he was the rider born highest last year, and he won the race, so maybe that's an omen. And also, even higher, I think, than Carapaz is our old mate, Darwin Atapuma, who I think is over 3,000 metres.
Currently over 3,000 metres.
Atapuma man. Atapuma man.
It was a good day for Wilco man. He climbed a place because Jonathan Caicedo, who was second overall, won on Etna a couple of days ago. He had a terrible day. He was in the King of the Mountains jersey as well, but he got dropped on the climb and he lost over 16 minutes. It was a tough day. It was a cold day. It was a long day. Not a lot of changes overall, but the yellow jersey Joao Almeida increased his overall. He was third on the stage, so he picked up a little time bonus.
Something happened in the baller group, didn't it? Just over the top of the climb, there were some big names who were struggling. One big name in particular who was struggling at the back of the peloton, Simon Yates, wasn't it? And you know, I've been flogging this dead horse of Simon Yates. Oh, well,
hope he's not listening.
Well, no, I mean, I've been the chief advocate of Simon Yates' enduring chances of winning this Giro d'Italia. I think he's still very much in it. And I spoke to him this morning about precisely that, whether he was still in the shake-up on GC.
Simon, I suppose third GC day of the Giro, really, with the time trial in the first mountain stage. Question is GC still the priority?
At the minute, yeah. Of course, it's not an ideal situation. But I think because of the weather changes in the prologue there, yeah, it's still a huge gap. I mean, I'm not completely out of it, so maybe they'll give me some more space to make up some time here and there. The old cliche is the race is real long. We've still got a long way to go. Like you just said, now it's only the third day of the GC sort of battle. So, there's plenty more chances to come. But we don't know.
Any more clarity on what happened and where that bad day came from on Etna?
Your guess is as good as mine. I'm only human, do my best. And that's what it is. I just hope to come up to a better level in the next coming days, really.
And just looking around at the strong teams and the favourites, a lot of teams have lost guys already or they've lost time. And it's one of the reasons why you're hopeful that there's not a lot of experience, there's not a lot of pedigree at the top of the general classification.
It's not that. I just think, like I said before, it's just there's so many stages that there is an opportunity to try something. You know, maybe today is one of those days. And there's just stages scattered around all these next weeks. So just to stay positive, really. I mean, that's all we can do with this situation. Because we came here with one goal, and that was the GC. So obviously it's not going to plan at the minute, but that can change. You know, it's still very, very clear in my memory when Froome won the Giro and I was leading. So, and I'm pretty sure he made up a bigger gap than what I'm down now. So now we'll stay positive and we'll go from there.
So that was Simon Yates, Rich, this morning, sounding pretty bullish. And I suppose a good day in the sense that he got through and didn't ultimately lose any time. Worrying signs, and we often talk about momentum, don't we, in Grand Tours, how it's very it's very difficult to turn momentum around, to turn that kind of oil tanker around. And that's my slight worry. I mean, Mitchelton, Scott and Simon, I think his direct sportif, Matt White, thought that it was an isolated bad day on Etna. Today maybe suggested otherwise. And I think they'll be maybe slightly more concerned after today. Well, the one silver lining is we haven't really got there's no real GC test for a few days now. So if he thinks that he can rediscover the form he had in Tirreno Adriatico, then he's got a few days to do it, to relocate that mojo.
Indeed, he moved up three places on GC up to 21st. Now, that's not what he came here for. Brandon McNulty had a bad day. He lost he slipped down 10 places to 18th, the young American rider. That's the Giro. There's been racing as well. Caught the end of Brabantse Pil, Julian Alaphilippe. I mean, he almost did it again. He put his hands up in there a little too early. Matthew van der Poel came storming up on the left and almost beat him, but didn't quite. Alaphilippe got away with it. So Alaphilippe won that ahead of van der Poel.
The king of premature celebration.
I thought Ganna was celebrating with 4Ks to go. Now, okay, he's very good over 4Ks. But I felt that was premature, but he wasn't celebrating. He was wanting the time check.
This is where, despite your best efforts to, I mean, now that you've got the Italian name, you're fully integrated, fully assimilated into the Italian culture and population. But this is where you're exposed, Richard, because he was making the classic Italian hand gesture, which tragically, amazingly, doesn't really have a name. It's the fingers.
It's very, very. And only Italians really do it well, don't they?
It's quintessentially Italian, and everyone recognises it as Italian, but that's what was going on.
Yeah,
there.
I thought he was celebrating. I was wrong. I misread.
He was looking for translation on his time gap, and he wasn't getting them.
And Benoit Cosnefroy was third. Really good ride by him, actually, to be with those two, Van der Poel and Alaphilippe, at the end of Brabantse Pil. In the morning was the women's race, and it was won by Grace Brown and Mitchelton Scott. She's been in great form. She was second at Liège, best on Liège. She won this race on her own. And that's really good for Mitchelton Scott because they, of course, are losing Annemiek van Vleuten. And I mean, Grace Brown could be one rider that really steps up. Leanne Lippert was second, and Flirty Mackay of Scotland was third.
You are listening to The Grandest Tour by The Cycling Podcast. Brought to you by iWalker. Flexible loans built for small businesses. Join 50,000 customers taking on life's twists and turns and scaling new heights with iWalker. If you run a business, find out more at iwalker.co.uk. iwoca.co.uk.
Thank you very much to our headline sponsor, iWalker, who began backing the Cycling Podcast back in March, and we're very grateful to them for their support. It enables us to be here. If you run a small business and you'd like to know a little bit more about what iWalker can do to help you, go to iwalker.co.uk. There's lots of information there, as well as advice about the loans that they offer, including the CBILS, the Coronavirus Business Interruption Loan Scheme.
I had hoped for a little bit more, that the crime would have been harder, but it wasn't really hard, it was just long.
Well, Rich, who do we hear from there?
That sounded very much like Jakob Fuglsang, Daniel.
Favourite for the Giro d'Italia?
Oof, that's a big call. Is he?
Well, the team is the doubt, isn't it? That's what we've been talking about thus far in the Giro. He's lost, how many guys has he lost now? He's lost
two.
He's lost two guys. He's lost
two good guys.
He's lost his two best guys in the mountains, Vlasov and Superman. So, question mark there. But Vincenzo Nibali lost someone today, didn't he?
He did, yeah. Peter Wiening. And as, well, you spoke to him at the start, didn't you?
I was.
Because he crashed yesterday.
I was. He crashed on a Bidon, shades of Geraint Thomas, crashed on a Bidon, finished the stage, seemed to be okay. And I spoke to him this morning just to check that he was indeed okay.
Well, first of all, Peter, quickly, how are you after the crash yesterday?
Oh, I'm okay. So I will see and find out today how everything goes. But yeah, at this moment I feel okay, so yeah.
And, I mean, to be here at the Giro d'Italia, just sort of sum up how unusual it is for you. You know, obviously you started the season thinking, well, you wouldn't be doing this kind of race, and how does it feel? And obviously having a chance, hopefully, to win the race with Vincenzo.
Yeah, it's a special feeling. After the Worlds last year, I was not expecting to be in the Bunzer this year. So, I'm happy to be here. And yeah, it's a little bit of a strange season, but yeah, in the end, it's a nice race to be in. It's also nice to have a guy in the team that can win the race. So yeah, it's a special. It's a special race.
And you're in an American team with a very Italian Giro team here. How's your Italian, and how's communication with Vincenzo, and how is working for him?
But all the guys do speak some words English, so. Everything works out well. I also do understand some Italian if they speak on the radio. So let's say race talk is I can understand. And but I'm on the room with Julien Bernard, and he's speaking pretty good English. No worries.
Well, Rich, we were quite surprised, weren't we, to hear the news that Wiening was out of the
Wien
race.
Dog.
Yeah, and it was a nice, well, it would have been and had been, up to this point, a nice story. He's been at Roompot quite a long time. I think he's been there since 2016, and then that team folded earlier this year, and Trek, who had already been interested in signing him, they took a punt on him at 39 years of age, and went straight into the Giro team, as we heard there, into this very sort of Italian-centric Trek Segafredo Giro team, and was shaping up to be one of Nibali's key men, really, in the mountains. The kind of guy you can rely on a lot of different terrain. But certainly I would have thought that Wiening might have been quite prominent in the third week when we get to the Alps and Dolomites.
Yeah, I mean, he's a former stage winner at the Giro, isn't he, when he was at Orica Green Edge. And if you want to know a bit more about Wiendog, he features in the fantastic episode put together by Mitch Docker about the 2014 Giro d'Italia. He was a member of the Orica Green Edge team there, and they won that team time trial. Mitch recreates it with all the members of the team, and it's really interesting because Wiening put them all in quite a lot of difficulty, and I think jeopardised the entire effort on the climb in that race. It's just brilliant to hear his take on that in contrast to everybody else's. But yeah, that, he would have been a a useful ally, wouldn't he, to Nibali?
It's just another nick in the armor.
However, I would say that they look good today, Trek Segafredo. They do have a pretty strong team.
They do. But I just look at the race as a whole, and you know, Trek Segafredo are the team, possibly with Jumbo-Visma, who I think at the moment are capable of controlling this race. But that's not many teams. It's two teams, I think, that are looking pretty strong, including, or particularly in the mountains. And, you know, they're not that experienced. Jumbo-Visma, the team that they brought here, okay, they've got Tolhoek and Bauman, who have done, you know, they've done Giri and they've done other Grand Tours before. But, you know, it's not the same level of experience and pedigree that they had at the Tour de France. And I just think that this race now is open to so many different scenarios, including, you know, very long range breaks. It was interesting, we heard Simon Yates talk about what had happened to him effectively in 2018 when Chris Froome had come from almost nowhere.
He has a strong team. I think, you know, Simon Yates has a strong team.
The other rider who has a strong team is Rafał Majka, I think.
He and does.
We've sort of pigeonholed Majka as a guy who goes for stages and
Patrick Conrad's only one place behind him on GC, and he won the group sprint for second today.
Yeah, Majka, we sort of think of him as a stage hunter or a King of the Mountains classification hunter, and someone who, when he has tried to do general classification, you know, he's either been around the sort of fifth, sixth, seventh place, or he's struggled and he hasn't delivered. But I think in this setting, in this environment, he becomes a very dangerous guy, and that's a team that hasn't suffered any notable misfortune yet.
It's an interesting thought, though, that you know, that a group could go away, and there aren't maybe teams strong enough to control the race. If it was a big enough group with strong enough riders, I'm looking, you know, a team like Sunweb, for example, because everyone's talking about Kelderman, but Jai Hindley is also up there overall, 13th. Mitchell and Scott have also got Lucas Hamilton. He's above Simon Yates. And Jack Haig's not that far away. He's 8 minutes. Okay, a bit further back. But, you know, strong riders who could infiltrate a break and really turn the race on its head, or help turn the race on its head.
I thought it was interesting today, just listening to Luke Roberts, the Sunweb coach here, or direct sportif here. He mentioned, well, Kelderman just missing out on the bonus second, so he finished fourth today. But he also immediately afterwards mentioned that Jai Hindley had a good day, almost as though Hindley is a co-leader.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much indeed to Science in Sport for their support of the Cycling Podcast. You can get 25% off all your Science in Sport products. Fantastic gels, bars, drinks, whatever you want. Energy bakes, like little cakes, they're my favourites. At scienceofsport.com with the code, Daniel?
25.
SISCP25. With immaculate timing, our menus have just arrived. Grazie.
Rich, I've seen straight away. So last night I talked about this typical Calabrian pasta, lagane e ceci. Which is a kind of tagliatelle, but it's typical of this region, and chickpeas.
Oh yes.
So I should be having that.
Great. Well, while we're studying the menu, why don't we hear from our old friend Ciro Scogna Emilio? Ciro, I spoke to you on day one when Ghana won the time trial. I'm obviously going to speak to you every day Ghana wins, but that was a surprising result today.
Really surprising. Certainly, I didn't expect it yesterday and not this morning. I think that Team Ineos, after the retirement of Geraint Thomas, was obliged to change his strategy in this race to catch not the overall, but to try to win stages. And Filippo today has done something really special.
Indeed, yes.
Ciro, more important matters. You must be miserable. This, and I think of you, Ciro, in the worst possible place and weather. It's cold, we're up the mountains.
But, you know, I was thinking not really about the weather, but about a possible question that I think that can be interested for our listeners. So maybe our listeners are wondering if me, after have been the shadow of Vincenzo Nibali for 15 years, the question could be, I could become the shadow of Filippo Ganna in the next 10 or 12 years? What do you think?
Well, Ganna, I think that's a great idea, Ciro, and it would guarantee your longevity. And because we were worried about your early retirement, we need you to hang around. Ganna could be the reason.
No, no, exactly. Also because Ganna, you know, is bigger than Vincenzo.
Well, I mean, you'd be in his shadow.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Should be. I mean, maybe his shadow. It's a problem for my, because normally I was looking for the sun.
Yeah.
So the shadow of the body of Filippo Ganna can be a problem for
what
me.
If Vincenzo is the shark, what is Ganna? What's his nickname?
Well, Ganna, you know the nickname, you know the film Top Gun with Tom Cruise. So in Italy, normally, for us, Ganna is Top Ganna, as the title of the film Top Gun.
Top Ganna.
Top
banana.
Ganna, exactly. This is the nickname of our Italian giant.
And Ciro, finally, is the shark the favorite in this race now?
Well, certainly with the retirement of Geraint Thomas and Simon Yates had a lot of troubles in Etna. In a certain way, Vincenzo can be a kind of lighthouse of this Giro, not as our famous lighthouse of Ivan Basso some years ago, but in my opinion, he has to be careful because there are important guys as Fusgang, Ed Kelderman, Kreuzvik, Maika, and I think that after the lesson of last year, in which, in a certain way, he underestimated the possibility of Carapaz, and at the end Carapaz won the Giro, I think that Vincenzo, the shark, and his famous coach that Daniel knows really well, Paolo Slongo, they certainly are not going to commit the same mistake.
Thank you, Ciro.
Paolo Slongo, Ciro, nickname?
The problem is that I don't know the meaning, how can say in English. I can...
Same word.
So, the nickname of our friend and great coach Paolo Slongo is Panda Slongo.
Well, Rich, I said I was looking forward to tasting the local pasta, but Ciro, not to be confused with Ciro, which is the, well, Ciro is one of the wines that are native to this region, and I was actually discussing them. So there's a white Ciro and a red Ciro, and I was discussing them with my new pal Valentino Sciotti of Vini Zabu, the president of Vini Zabu. We were discussing them earlier, and I was asking him what we should drink tonight in Calabria, and he said, yeah, go for the, give the Ciro, the red Ciro, a go, and it's an unusual red grape called Gallioppo, I believe, not really seen anywhere else, I don't think, and yeah, quite tannic, quite intense, the kind of red wine that I enjoy, so I'm looking forward to that.
Looking forward to some intense red wine, and we're in a very, I mean, we are in a really nice place here, it's very plush, but it's so cheap, isn't it? I mean, the south of Italy as a whole, but the south in particular, is very good value for money. You can eat extremely well for very little.
But be careful of those bridges.
Oh, yeah. The bridges.
Well, we shouldn't joke about this, Rich, because, of course, 2 years ago, the bridge in near Genoa collapsed, the Ponte Morandi. The images, I think, the pictures went around the world. But since then, there's been a bit of an inquest into how that happened, and the realization that a lot of the bridges in Italy, the viaducts, the tunnels, are not in very good shape and need to be repaired. And the one of the most shocking revelations early in the course, in the process of that investigation, I suppose, on a national level, was that no one really knew who the bridges belonged to. There were 1,200 or 1,400 bridges, viaducts, tunnels, whose owner was unknown, the Italian government established. So no one had been maintaining them, no one was claiming them. And today, on our drive to the finish, we went over, how many viaducts did we go over? Maybe 20, 30?
Well, I wasn't counting.
Well, there were a lot, weren't there?
We went under one that looked very rickety indeed.
Some of them high, some of them, well, quite significant, and a lot of them at the moment down here in Calabria. So of those 1,200 or so, 150 were in Calabria, and those unaccounted bridges and viaducts in particular, and a lot of them being repaired, we've noticed at the moment, haven't we? But I was quite nervous, not quite nervous napalm, not quite as nervous as Lionel would have been, but still
going over
them.
Well, it's such mountainous countryside. That was the thing that struck me when I was first here 4 years ago, I guess, that 2016 Giro, the first one we covered in full. We were down here, Lionel remembered my 84 point turn in the Maserati in a small village in this neck of the woods. But I remember being surprised just by how mountainous it was down here. I don't know why that came as a surprise, but I suppose we're so familiar with the mountain ranges in the north or up the middle, that the it's like almost like rainforest in places. It's very kind of wild and uninhabitable, although there are these villages perched on top of mountains as well.
Well, we've been in Calabria today. We're going to start in Calabria at Castrovillari tomorrow. Shortly after the start, we're going to go past a place that Lionel and I have quite fond memories of, I think, a place called Civita, which is like an Albanian colony in Calabria, and where they speak 16th century or 15th century Albanian dialect, and we had some great food a few years ago. But we're going into Basilicata, home region of Domenico Pozzovivo.
Well, today's stage went a kilometre from where?
200 meters, I heard, from
where he crashed. Well, he told me this morning it was a kilometer.
Well, he told La Gazzetta 200 meters, so maybe he was lying. God.
Well, I mean, I spoke to him. We're going to have him in an episode. Kilometer
Pozzo
zero
fraud.
But he had a terrible crash, didn't he? End of last year, he was hit by a car in his home region, and he said the course they passed a kilometer from where that happened.
It's been interesting, Rich. Just I've seen a couple of interviews with him in the last few days, and what we've been saying about we don't want to stress this too much, and we don't want to disrespect or belittle the abilities of some of the riders who are contending for the Giro, but it's been notable that Pozzovivo has talked about, well, looking around him and thinking, well, hang on, you know, having thought that maybe I could get a top five, now maybe I should aim even higher than that, or I can aim even higher than that. And I thought today's move, where he just went to the front with about 500 meters to go, I think, before the King of the Mountains, I thought that was maybe fruit of that realization that actually there's no one here really that he should be afraid of.
He looks uncomfortable. His arm is at an awkward angle. He never looks particularly comfortable on the bike, Pozzovivo, but he does seem to be riding very well. I asked him what percentage he was at in terms of, because he was riding the Tour de France, of course. He crashed out of the Tour de France, made a very quick decision to come here. He said 100%.
He says his position's a bit unusual, but he's having an operation after the Giro.
He's lost a lot of muscle in that arm. I mean, it's very skinny.
And team-wise, you know, he might fare better than people would imagine. He's got a very good young Italian domestique called Matteo Sobrero, who we featured on the podcast before, who will go back to wine at this point. His family are winemakers in Piedmont, and I was speaking to him a couple of days ago. His thoughts are, you know, they're half at the Giro, half back in Piedmont, where his family are. They've already harvested, he was telling me, the Dolcetto and the Barbera, and they'd moved on to the Nebbiolo this week. So, you know, he was making regular phone calls to his family back in Montelupo Albese to see how the harvest was going.
Well, I mean, what a strange stage it was today to have a winner like Filippo Ganna. We haven't really spoken about him. Ciro spoke a little bit about him.
And what a link. Matteo Sobrero goes out with Filippo Ganna's sister. Or is it the other way around? No, it's that way around.
Yes, it is that
Matteo
way around.
Goes out with his sister.
I mean, a bizarro kind of stage. He showed real brass neck, Ganna, to do what he did after his dalliance with the breakaway. You're looking at me suspiciously.
I'm missing something here.
Those three references were all for the wedding present fans that I know now are out there, because some of you enjoyed my reference last night to Sea Monsters. They're classic album, which I'll play in the car. Now we've got a working car. I'll play it in the car one day. Daniel will absolutely hate it. I guarantee
that.
But it's really good.
I'll exact revenge with something like, what could I get revenge with? Some Dr. Dre or something.
Taylor Swift. I think one of the talking points, I think this is something that will feature in our episode of Kilometer Zero this week, which will be the diarists again, is the weather. It was cold and wet today. The darkness fell kind of quite quickly after the stage, and that's quite an odd thing to get your head around. And at the Giro, normally, you know, in May, it's a time of, you know, freshness and new, and the year is just kind of revving up. The weather's getting warmer, and it's full of promise. And at this time of year, it's kind of the opposite. There's death is in the air. You know, the trees are dying, the plants are dying. The nights are drawing in. It's a completely different vibe, I find.
It is. You just reminded me of something, Rich, that we were also going to touch on briefly. Bidons, the question of water bottles. Peter Weening crashed on a water bottle yesterday. Obviously, Geraint Thomas had done the day before. We heard a couple of things from riders today or from other journalists that one thing that's been mentioned is that the tops, and you're going to have to intervene at this point because you're doing a lot of cycling, as you've been telling everyone on the podcast recently. The tops on the bidons are such, or a lot of the team's bidons are such, that the bottles don't explode anymore or the tops don't come off easily if, for example, a wheel goes over the top, which they used to do. And I think Peter Weening told one of our Dutch colleagues yesterday after his crash that was the problem, that the particular bidon that he'd slid on or he'd ridden over had stayed intact. The top hadn't come off, and it was pretty much a full bead on. It was quite a solid object when his front wheel hit it.
Indeed. Well, that
sounds very interesting. That
no, I am. I am interested. I mean, I think there's something in that, and we must. I saw Michael Barry tweeting about that as well. We must ask. Who would we ask about that? Soigneurs, mechanics, not mechanics, soigneurs, but it is a problem. They kind of lock, they can lock now, can't they? And that maybe prevents them, the tops from coming off so easily. But also I think the bottle cages have got to be looked at, and you know, sometimes you can't help bottles coming flying out, but you know, a rider like Geraint Thomas is paid what, £4 million a year. And this was his big target, for him to be taken out of the race in the neutralized zone. That's a kind of big problem. And we haven't managed to speak to anyone at Ineos about it yet, really. But we'll try to do so over the next few days.
I don't know about you, Rich, but I'm looking forward to my filetuccio di suino nero bardato al guanciale su crema di patate viola con riduzione al vino rosso. My fillet of black pork dressing, bacon on purple
when
potato
that,
cream
when
with red
that,
wine reduction.
When you order that, I might just go, do it. I might just go for the same. Let's see. But before we go, Daniel, some quick thank yous to friends of the podcast. Thank you very much from me to David Casey, Thomas Fish, Heath Mannion, Patrick Mackay, Ian Halliday, and Kieran Williams.
And from me to Luigi Bernardi, Benjamin Jensen, Damien Kerr, Oliver Dorr, Scott Tindall, James Puttock, and Felicity Cloak.
Felicity Cloak. Thank you, Felicity.